Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Revolution Radio. We are very happy tonight to have a historic discussion with Commander Charles Kirshner and Attorney Mario Apuzzo about their recent filings in the Supreme Court. I'd like to start out by really wishing everyone a welcome. I especially hope that members of our military are listening, and any parents, sisters, brothers, sons or daughters of military members are listening this evening, because what we are talking about is really nothing short of a major constitutional crisis, having an ineligible commander-in-chief serving in that office. This issue cannot be underestimated, its seriousness, and as you noted on my blog today, that the usurper thon is going to continue to call attention to this case and why the Supreme Court needs to hear it. I'm just going to talk about a few things before our callers come on. Tonight we are basically going to go over the four questions presented before the Supreme Court, what a writ actually does, what it's attempting to do, and what the questions are and what the legal basis for all of those questions are. There were four presented to the court, and I will post the link again for you in this document. So I'm going to kind of lay out some of those questions for Attorney Apuzzo and Commander Kirshner, and then ask a few questions in there, particularly on the standing issue, because that is fundamental to our Constitution. Our Constitution and the Declaration of Independence protect our individual rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, due process, and so forth. It's not a broad area in which that occurs. So we'll be talking about all of those, some questions, and then we are going to open it up for questions, but we will be screening questions tonight because we really want issues to relate directly to this case. As you know, this is such a historic case. It's not really about comparison with other cases and so forth, or who's better and who isn't, or what's included or not. This is what we have. This is probably our best chance before the Supreme Court. And at this point, I'd like to, I believe, welcome Commander Kirshner and Attorney Apuzzo. Are you there?
Hello, Dr. Kate. This is me, Mario Apuzzo. Nice to be with you.
Good evening. Good evening. Commander Kirshner, is that you?
Yes. Yes, I'm here. How's the audio level? Sometimes I have a little trouble here with my phone with the volume.
Okay. It sounds all right now, and I'm just going to put that out there in the chat room. If you have any trouble with audio, please let us know, but it sounds fine. I'd like to welcome you both, not only because you are my absolute favorite guest to have on, but because of the work you have done, I commend you. We had an introductory song here about people who love their country more than themselves, and I think you both are that example, and would like to thank you again for coming this evening.
Thank you for having us, Dr. Kate.
I agree.
Well, great.
Kiddos.
Great. Well, what we're going to start out with, I thought what we would do is I have posted in the chat room the four, basically the four questions that you presented to the Supreme Court. And I'd sort of like to go through all of those, if you will, explaining that. But first, can you place for us, in the context of all the proceedings, which started at 2:50 a.m. on January 20th, 2009, where this writ is within the context of all the proceedings and what it means to write a writ? For example, just in my layman's place, the writ is really asking the Supreme Court and telling them why they should consider this case. It's not meant to re-argue every small detail. So let's start from there, either one, and then we'll go through the four questions.
All right. The first thing we have to understand that this what I submitted is not a writ; it's a petition.
Excuse me. Sorry.
Yeah.
Petition.
Well, you're not. Yeah.
A petition for
writ.
Sorry.
Many people do that, and I just that's why I wanted to correct that now, so that way then we can start using the right language. It's a petition, and it asks for a writ. Okay. The writ basically is an order from the Supreme Court directed to the lower court, which is the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, ordering them to certify the record and bring it up to the Supreme Court. So that's what the writ of certiorari is telling the lower court, okay, certify the record and give it to me so that I can review it for error. And the petition asks that the court do that, okay? So I just wanted to make sure that's clear for everybody. And basically it starts out, you file a complaint in the federal district court. That's, of course, that's how you start the case. We did that January 20th, 2009, before President-elect Obama was sworn in. So he was still a private person, but more than a private person because he had won the general election, the popular vote, and he also had won the electoral vote. So now the only thing that had to be done was for Congress to confirm him. They confirmed him So now he is the president-elect, confirmed by Congress. There is really nothing left to be done in the political process. Just got to swear him in. And that's when, you know, we sued him at that point. And then just to add, we also sued him after he was sworn in. So now the executive powers have vested in him, so he has the powers to take action against my clients, the plaintiffs, one of which, of course, we have with us tonight, Commander Kirchner. Okay, so that starts that. Then that case gets dismissed by the district court on the motion to dismiss filed by the government saying that we didn't have standing. Okay, and at that point, they had two arguments, Article 3 standing, which is constitutional standing, and prudential standing, which is not found in the Constitution, but it's basically made by the courts. It's like a self-policing type standing. It's kind of hard to understand the difference between the two, but just let's, you know, for sake of argument, let's just continue so we don't get bogged down in that. And then they also argued political question. They argued immunity. They argued many different things. But the court granted on Article 3 standing, prudential standing, and political question. That was the district court. Then it went on appeal to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia. Again, the arguments were basically standing, and these other. I argued that the court below had erred. The Third Circuit Court of Appeals said no Article 3 standing. They didn't reach the question of prudential standing. They didn't reach the question of political question or nothing else, just Article 3 standing. They said no Article 3 standing. That therefore affirmed. And affirmed means I agree with the lower court, therefore the case is rightfully dismissed. Okay? Then from there, we have to petition the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, the petition is basically, you know, it's asking the court to accept the case. There's no right to accept it. It's not original jurisdiction. The Constitution provides for very limited circumstances where you can have original jurisdiction. Over the years, the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court has been cut back. You know, in many years ago, my God, they used to argue oral arguments for days. And, you know, the Supreme Court, they were basically reviewing every case that was filed there. And then over the years, Congress just kept cutting back and cutting back and cutting back the jurisdiction. So now it's, you get very little review by the U.S. Supreme Court, very little. And so that's why you have to file a petition, which you're asking the court to review the case, as I explained earlier, you know, and you're asking for this writ. So that's where we are. And it's a very, very technical process, very limited. You got to write this petition in a certain way. It's got to be presented with the questions and then everything else that's in there that you've probably read, the petition. So now that brings us to the questions. And now, having said all that, let me, you know, give it back to you, Dr. Kay and Kate. I'm sorry, and then see where you want to go from there. Hello.
I'm still here.
Oh, what happened?
Dr. Kate?
Hang on. No, I'm here. Hang on. Sorry. It just takes I have three computers in front of me, and it takes a while. So, yes, thank you very much for that explanation. And I just have to laugh because I practiced so much with Charles on petition versus writ, and, of course, I just blew it. But thank you for the lesson. All right. These are the questions you presented. They're unique, everyone. This is really sort of a culmination. If you've kept up with these filings, this is really where the meat is. So here's the first question. Whether petitioners sufficiently articulated a case or controversy against respondents, which gives them Article III standing to make their Fifth Amendment due process and equal protection claims against them.
Yes, and what is your question about the question?
The issue is...
I guess she wants you to elaborate on it, Mario.
Yeah,
okay.
Just basically, tell us what you argued there, why you came up with that question in particular, because, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, you didn't ask about this or ask about that.
Maybe I can throw in Dr. Kate. When I learned this too, you know, When this petition goes to the Supreme Court, they don't want all the detail. They want you to give them two or four questions that boiled down why they should issue the writ of certiorari to take the case up. So Mario had he was literally up to 3 a.m. trying to boil this down into 4 questions. At the Supreme Court level, it's completely different than at the lower court. So they want bullets right up front,
yes,
the first page, 4 questions, and then they give them 30 pages to expand on it. But that's what these questions are. They have to be, interesting enough that they will take the case. Is that going to sum it up, Mario?
Yes. The questions have to be worded very, very carefully. No, they can't be argumentative. They can't be repetitive. For example, you can ask a question. If another question is fairly assumed or fairly included in that question, then that's it. You know, you don't ask the other question. Okay? So you have to really spend a lot of time on the questions, because you've got to be able to show what the case is about, because they really don't have much time to look at these petitions. They look at it very
quickly.
I'm sorry?
Have to compel them to take it.
Yeah,
you get about 18,000 a year, I heard, and you got to, like, in these questions, anywhere from 1 to 4, they don't like more than 4, according to what I read, you got to give them something to say there. This is really, really important that requires the Supreme Court to take up this case, to bring it up with a writ of certiorari, that this question has to be answered.
Yeah, it's
now,
what you said
from the history is essentially all the courts have said, no, you don't have Article III standing and prudential standing, but basically Article III standing. So your first question here says, look, we do. Here's enough. Did we give you enough information to establish that standing? And I believe this basically gets down as well to individual liberty, what's guaranteed under the Constitution and protection. So go ahead from there.
Yeah, now there's a very carefully chosen word in that first question, the word sufficiently.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because when you get down to standing, I mean, that's all you really have to do is just say enough of a case. Okay, you don't have to prove your case. That's not where, you know, you're having a trial and you're proving the case. You just have to have enough of a case articulated, which basically means that you've presented enough evidence, factual evidence, showing that you have this, first factor is injury in fact, okay? Injury in fact. So the word sufficiently is very important because, again, you know, that's a judgment call it's really a tough one to get a hold of because, if you read these cases on standing, it's unbelievable what they turn on. I'll give you an example. The Lujan case, okay? Very, very famous case. I mean, that right now sets the standards for establishing Article III standing, where you have to show injury in fact, causation, and redressability. Okay, now, in that case...
Can I just say something, Mario? That
yes.
These rules that they judge standing on were created by the court. They are not in the Constitution.
Yes. The only thing that's in the Constitution, and that's why I picked that in my question, is case or controversy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's in the Constitution.
Right.
But that's what the court uses. They use that in order to create the concept or the doctrine of standing. So the whole argument about standing kind of gets lost. Because you have to understand, you know, what does it connect to? Well, it connects to a case or controversy, okay? So when the court says you have no standing, what they're saying is you have not presented a case or controversy. It's very important to understand that, okay? So that's why I said articulated a case or controversy, you see? Because that's what the Constitution requires, and that's what standing is really about. It's about a case or controversy.
And in the first question... Mario specifically goes to the Fifth Amendment rights of due process and equal protection claims against them. And the equal protection claims goes to protection of minority from the majority in the sense that the majority can just vote something and ignore the Constitution and minority have to live with it till the next election. Well, that's not equal protection under the Constitution. As in the case of McCain getting the people listen to for McCain, and he gets investigated for his natural-born citizen status. But Obama, with 10 times as many people bringing the protest to the Congress and even lawsuits, he doesn't get investigated for the lack of equal protection. So that first question there, you know, I think Mario sufficiently laid out the whole concept of standing and pointed out that the fifth, you know, have we showed sufficiently articulated case or controversy that they violated my Fifth Amendment's due process and equal protection claims? I think we have, but we're asking the Supreme Court now to see, to show that the lower court maybe didn't recognize that we have shown sufficient and articulated a case of controversy. I think we have. The lower court says we haven't. So we're asking the question to the Supreme Court, if I can paraphrase what I've learned from Mario, we're asking them to say, hey, we think you have shown a sufficient and articulated a sufficient case.
Yeah, I mean, and just so it doesn't get lost here, because for some reason, I don't know why, you know, there must be some kind of magic in the sky or something, but it got lost in the district court. It got lost in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, and now it's getting lost right now as we speak. But for some reason, there must be some magic to it. On the Fifth Amendment, okay, the whole concept of your life, liberty, safety, security, tranquility, and property, okay, those are rights that come out of the Fifth Amendment, the due process rights, unalienable rights that are spoken about in the Declaration of Independence, okay, you know, given to us by our Creator. Mm-hmm. And now, that is connected to the Fifth Amendment. That's not connected to the equal protection argument. And those rights right there are the ones that are being injured by Obama and Congress. Okay? That argument was never addressed by either one of the lower courts. They just talked about – I'm sorry?
Sorry. Please go ahead.
Yeah. They basically said that we complained about general grievances against the government, you know, general grievances. We didn't complain about general grievances. We complained about specific constitutional unalienable rights, okay, which I just you know, gave you a list of them. And,
yes,
and then I explained how those rights are being violated by an individual who's supposed to be a natural-born citizen. You know, he's wielding this power. He's wielding the executive and the military power of the nation. And my clients, the plaintiffs, okay, have not consented to this individual being the president because he's not a natural born, and you know, wielding this power, he's injuring them. From the moment that he took office, he continues to injure them. He will continue to injure them while he's in office, because according to the founders, you cannot trust a person to be president who's not a natural born citizen. You know, it's a safety issue, okay? The whole idea, if you study natural law, if you study the whole idea of keeping aliens out of your country, going back to time immemorial, it's a nation's sovereign right to keep out people who are not of your nation for safety purposes. For safety purposes. That gives a nation the right to keep somebody out who's not, you know, a citizen or who's, you know, inadmissible, whatever you want to call it, okay? So it's all tied to safety, national security. The founding fathers gave it to us in the Constitution, in the Natural Born Citizen Clause, as it applies only to the president, okay, which is a singular position,
mm-hmm.
singular, okay? So it all ties to protection.
That's why we created the
government. Yeah, that's why
we created the federal government to protect us, protect our unalienable rights, and in return for that, I will give them my allegiance.
Right.
Correct. Now, let me just add one other thing that I think is under fundamental assault here, and it has to do with the standing, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but basically our Constitution protects our individual rights, not just a mass, not just
correct.
A group. It protects
especially the minority.
Yes, and so the standing issue has been very much related to, hey, you know, you didn't suffer any more injury than all of Americans did. But our Constitution protects individuals. So I think that's also a fundamental of not only one of your strongest arguments is to link the need, you know, the Constitution's protection of our individual rights, but it's a very fundamental test for the Supreme Court.
Yes, exactly, and that's very important what you just said, Dr. Kate, because that's the reason why I suspect that neither the lower court, the district court, nor the Court of Appeals even mentioned or touched my argument about the Fifth Amendment. They broad-brushed it and called it general grievances, okay? But I said, wait a minute. These are not general grievances. These are individual rights, just like you just said, individual rights. Okay, each one of us has an individual right to life, liberty, property. Okay, well, that's what's written in the Fifth Amendment. Now, out of liberty, you can put in there, of course, safety. I mean, how could you say safety is not in that? And security and tranquility. I mean, the Declaration of Independence even talks about tranquility. It's all part of that. Those are individual rights. Okay, it's not a general grievance. Okay, that's shared by everybody. You know, if my client has those individual rights, and if those individual rights are not being adequately protected, okay, by the government, then my clients have a right to go into court and ask for protection of those rights, which the government is supposed to protect, which they're not doing, because you got somebody who's not a natural born citizen as the president, who you can't trust, according to the founding fathers, can't trust them. Okay. So, and that's very important what you just said, and that, again, that was totally avoided by both courts in our case, and I'm glad you focused on that.
I look at the founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, as the promise, and the Constitution is the fulfillment of that promise, the protection of our unalienable rights, which the founders fought and died for. I'm a direct descendant of a militiaman who served in the Revolutionary War, and they fought that bloody battle to gain their unalienable rights back after the British King was just ignoring them. And if you read the Declaration of Independence today and just put in the word Obama for King George and Congress for the Parliament, boy, it sure fits like hand in glove. And we have to, once again, apparently stand up and fight for unalienable rights, because they're being usurped. And just because the political will temporarily of the majority wants to ignore the Constitution, we can't be told to go to the polls in 2 years. And meanwhile, the Constitution is null and void for 2 years. That's a ridiculous answer. That's one of the answers the courts gave us. We demand a protection promised in the Declaration of Independence and fulfilled in the Constitution. The Constitution is the fundamental law of this country, and we have to stay a nation of laws and not men, or this country will fall apart.
Yeah, and something else, too, I want to add to that is the concept of these unalienable rights. Okay, now, under the colonies, the rights came from the king, came from the crown. Okay, but the founding fathers, they recognized that these rights do not come from the king, and they do not come from the government. They come from natural law and the creator, nature's God. Okay,
right.
That's where they come from. Now, when they talk about the Creator, I mean, you know, somebody might say, "Oh, that sounds religious," you know.
And Obama just left that out of the Declaration of Independence.
Yes, which is very, very dangerous, because you gotta always remember, and you gotta always keep it in the psyche and in the culture of your nation, that those rights come from the Creator, not from the government. Okay, that's very, very important.
Right.
Now, when we talk about Creator, I'm not, you know, preaching some religion or anything like that. The Creator could be anything that you know within your own soul, within your own conscience, you know, gives you these rights. Okay, if you believe in God, then they come from God. If you believe in nature,
a higher power than man himself.
Yeah, they come from nature. If you believe in
right.
the universe, whatever you believe in, that's where these rights come from. But the important point to understand is that they do not come from the government, because we the people, we created the government so that they can protect our rights. So we already had the rights.
Right.
You know, we already had them. nature gave us the rights, or our creator, whatever you want to choose for that, depending on your faith. So that's very important to understand that, and that's what we're looking to have protection here.
And the revolutionaries fought a many-year war to prove that point. And once they won the freedom to use their God-given unalienable rights, they created a government to protect those rights, and they created the Constitution is there to a social contract that government is supposed to make sure that the people's unalienable rights are protected in perpetuity for generations to come. And there's a way to amend the Constitution, a legal way. They put that in there too. It isn't set in stone. But you just can't do it with a simple vote and say, I'm not going to follow this part of the Constitution anymore, and you 49% that lost the election, tough. That's not the way this system works.
And to tie it all together, which underscores to everyone out there the brilliance of just this first question, because it pulls everything forward. The attack on our individual rights is protected by the Constitution.
Right.
The use of standing, of judicial invention to basically, again, perpetuate an attack on our individual rights, or ignoring that for whoever's listening, and to eliminate our opportunity for the exercise of our Fifth Amendment rights and duties as we are entitled to. So all of
every word in that question, Mario, put in there for
correct.
A reason. There's not one word too many in that question, and not one word too little. Every word in that question has meaning to it. And Mario could take those words one by one and tell you why they're there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not any extra one. And there's not any extra ones.
That's correct. And I also want to highlight again what Mario said and what we all and Commander Kirshner have been talking about is the national security, the safety of our country, and how critical that is. And through the course of this historic research in this case, the things you unearthed and wrote about, Commander, on James Madison's first view of Article 2, Section 1,
right.
Clause 5, and how it was, in fact, changed. And perhaps you could just share that story as
well
before we move on to now the discussion of NBC.
Alexander Hamilton proposed in the first draft he prepared of the proposed Constitution that the eligibility clause as to citizenship would simply require a person be born a citizen, meaning a native born a citizen. When 4 to 5 weeks later, when John Jay learned of this, he was very much concerned about foreign influence after the revolutionaries were gone and somebody working their way back into the halls of the government with foreign influence on them, and taking back control and giving us back to the British, for example, or some other power. So he wrote a letter to John Jay wrote a letter to George Washington saying, we have to strengthen that clause. We need to put in, he said, let me hint, in other words, let me suggest, as a strong check to the person to the command of our military will devolve, that he shall be a natural-born citizen, not just born a citizen or a citizen by birth. A natural-born citizen, and that adjective natural goes to the parents, and it comes from Vattel and the Law of Nations, where a natural-born citizen, Vattel used the word naturels, and that was translated in 1781 in the Articles of Confederation, even before the Constitution was written, the word naturels was translated in a treaty discussions to mean natural-born. So the naturels that Vattel wrote in French translates to the natural-born citizens. He defined what he meant by that word. Those are the children of the citizens' parents born in the country. Born in the country to citizen parents, plural. So that is what George Washington got from John Jay. We needed to strengthen the eligibility clause on citizenship status that only a natural-born citizen can ever get in command of our military. George Washington got it, it was stuck in, and the rest is history. And anybody that tries to say a natural born is the same as a native born, as we understand it today, where you're born in the country. That particular debate and that particular first proposal of what the eligibility clause should read and what it was changed to and why is a strong check against foreign influence. The only way you can have a person born with no foreign influence at birth, either from being the rules of birth, location, and who your parents are, is to have yourself born in the country of two citizen parents of that country so that you have no other claim on you by international law from another country that your mother was a citizen of my country, so I claim you, or your father was a citizen of this country, so they claim you, or you're born outside the USA in another country, so they claim you. Unity of citizenship at birth, sole allegiance at birth is what they wanted for the commander of our military. That's what a natural-born citizen is. Mario wrote a superb essay on that called Unity of Citizenship. It was published in the Washington Times. And that's what happened. They actually changed it from being born a citizen as being acceptable to a natural-born citizen. Now, if there was no difference, why did they change it? John Jay's letter explained why they changed it, too, because there is a difference.
Yeah, if I can add to that, the founders, the framers, they were so clever when they wrote things. They knew that Congress was also clever. They knew that too. They knew that they had the power to naturalize. So what Congress does, they can pass a law that says that you are a born citizen. They can actually do that.
Naturalize back to birth.
Yeah, they can say, well, you're a born citizen now, okay? In other words, you could be born anywhere or in any kind of situation, and they could declare you to be a born citizen, and which is what the British did. You were a naturalized citizen, and they called you a natural born subject, and you were naturalized. Okay?
And we have a statutory law, Title 8, Section 1401, that handles that. If you're born overseas to two U.S. citizens, you're born a citizen.
Yeah, so the founders, they recognized that, and they said, wait a minute. And that's why, like Hamilton, he just said, born a citizen. The founders realized that you could mess around with that. You could play with that, and you can create born citizens. So they said natural born. Natural
and only
born.
Only nature can create natural born citizens. No
yeah,
law.
Right. There's no law that can do it. You can't acquire it somehow. You can't create it with a law, with a statute, whatever. And again, then the question is, well, what's natural born? Because when you're born, there's two things that happen, not just one. You're born in a place, and you're also born to someone. Those are the natural elements of birth.
Now,
and
before we Just hang on 1 second, because that's going to lead us right into your second question, which I posted, which is basically whether Obama can be an Article II natural-born citizen if he was born in the United States to a U.S. mother and a non-U.S. citizen, British father, under the British
Nationality
Act.
You're reading the question
Act.
Now, right? Question number two,
I am.
Right? Okay.
1948. But basically, your second question goes to that, but I just wanted to, like, sort of collect what we have here. So,
I interrupted you, Dr. K. Could you read it again so it's clear to everybody? I didn't know you started the second question and I interrupted you.
Oh, well, let me, before I read did that, because I interrupted myself, I think, and interrupted Mario, because we are getting to the question of what a natural-born citizen is. And I wanted to note for our audience, and just plain as day, but up to this point, the argument against this case from Obama has just been about standing. They've done nothing. They've put forth no alternative explanation, no reasoning, no documentation, no nothing. They've hoped like heck this has gone away. I've called it a straw man's case. And so
it's worse than that, Dr. Kate, because the lower court assumes that all the merits and facts are true. Correct,
that's
Mario?
That's correct.
Yes, which they only say that, but they really are not applying it. Because if they have to assume that Obama is not a natural born citizen and that he hasn't proven that he was born in America or in Hawaii, I mean that's a big deal right there.
Right.
Because you have to assume that if you're going to do a motion to dismiss our case.
Now, again, just let me just make a couple of announcements. Folks, we've got folks on the phone with their hands raised. I just wanted to let you know that we're going to allow this to go all the way through the four questions, so I don't anticipate taking any questions till for about another half hour or so. So if you hang on, that'll be fine. So anyway, just from that standpoint, yes. So let's move into the second question, which is about not only what a natural-born citizen is, but everyone listen to this very carefully. And pardon me for interrupting the flow, but I think we keep it going this way. Here's the question. Whether putative, remember, it's never called president, putative President Obama can be an Article II, quote, natural-born citizen if he was born in the United States to a United States citizen mother and a non-United States citizen British father, and under the British Nationality Act of 1948, he was born a British citizen. That lays out hundreds of pages of work and so forth. So let's move on from there, Mario, again with our same discussion. This is the meat of natural-born citizens. And here you've invoked a number of other citizenship acts, the British Nationality Act, and so forth. So we all want to hear again how you got to that point. Other people argue, you know, oh, that's natural-born citizen means only born in the USA. So both of you, please, just take it on from there. The second question is, can he be a natural-born citizen? Again, note the wording. Please go from there.
Okay. And boiling down hundreds and hundreds of pages of briefings into one question. Boy, what a masterpiece Mario did here.
Correct. Congratulations.
Yeah, you're right about hundreds and hundreds of pages. You have to think really hard how to say something like this. So I guess both of you appreciate having to come up with a question like that. But here's, first of all, this is just as an aside, where I said British Nationality Act 1948, I didn't forget to say of. That's how the British cite their law. They don't say of 1948, okay? Just British Nationality Act 1948. I just wanted to clear that up for everybody. It wasn't that I forgot to put of in there. Okay, now, this says if he was born in the United States, okay? So now that leaves open the remember earlier when we talked about the questions? If you have a question and another question is subsumed within that or is like, you know, implied within it, you're good to go. You don't have to keep saying all the other questions. So that question right there fairly raises the question if he was born in the United States. Okay? So you've covered the other issue about the birth certificate. Okay? Now, I don't know whether, Dr. Kate, whether you realize that when in reading that question, but it's in there, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, so assuming that, now let's assume that he was born here. Let's assume that. And let's assume that he was born to a citizen mother and a non-United States citizen father, and also because of the British National Act of 1948, he was born a British citizen. You know, assuming those facts to be true, can he be a natural-born citizen? Now, of course, you have to have a definition of a natural-born citizen in order to answer that question. So it raises the question also of what is a natural-born citizen. You see, so that question raises many, many other questions. It raises the question, well, wait a minute, how is he a British citizen under the Nationality Act? How is he, was his mother a citizen? Well, yes. Well, how is his father not a U.S. citizen? Then you explain that part, okay? So there's all kinds of different, elements to that. But assuming that you put the
whole
thing together.
Well, let me throw in at this point, Mario, real quick, is that if they take the case, Mario gets a chance to brief all these questions.
Well, not necessarily true.
No?
Completely.
Okay.
No, let me explain why. Because the Supreme Court, if they accept the case, they will tell us what questions they want to deal with.
All right.
You see? So
okay.
I've argued in the petition that, you know, given the nature and the importance of the underlying merits, okay, that they should also reach the merits, notwithstanding the fact that neither of the lower courts reached the merits. You see? So
right.
That question there, number two, goes to the merits of the case.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not about standing. That's about
right.
The merits. Okay? Now, again, the merits, we all know that no court, except maybe one court, okay, which was not a federal court, the Indiana court, they reached the question of what is a natural-born citizen. And, again, I don't want to even talk about that.
But they didn't even – they just stated it. They didn't even do any investigation. In fact, they said that they called Vattel, who was the most preeminent scholar on the law of nations of his era for 100 years. They called him some unknown Swiss philosopher.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Right.
And if amicus curia brief of a case argued yesterday at the Supreme Court, they in that brief said that Vattel was the most preeminent scholar on the law of nations of his time. Right in there in front of the Supreme Court yesterday, they mentioned Vattel. And this case in Indiana, what was the name? Anke case?
Anke.
The state judge says, oh, some unknown Swiss philosopher, I'm supposed to believe what he wrote?
Right. It is shocking, absolutely shocking.
Shocking.
And the case that Charlie's talking about is Ruben Flores Villar versus United States of America.
That was the one from yesterday.
Yeah. Not only is that brief tells about Vattel, but there's oh my God, there's so many writings, law reviews and case law, commentaries. I mean, it's just endless the amount of information that is buried and that has been forgotten, okay, that tells us who Vattel is. Okay. There's like a mountain of information. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that case
could be helping us in educating the court on Vattel.
This Ruben Flores Villar?
Yeah.
Yes. But,
and the press and the lawyers of this country who have conveniently wanted to forget Vattel could be reminded by that case.
Yes, absolutely.
The progressives want to forget Vattel because he believed in a strong constitution, a written constitution.
Yeah, but anyway, so let's see, where were we? The second question. The question then is, what is a natural-born citizen? And, we've already touched upon it, but let me just give some information. And I know Charlie, he's got a lot of information on that. But anyway, basically, Vattel says that a natural-born citizen is a child born in the country of citizen parents. That's what he says, very, very simple. And it also says the natives or the natural born. See, there's a lot of confusion about this word natives, a lot of confusion about that. In the beginning of our country, native and natural born meant the same thing. Okay?
The word federalist. A federalist back then was one for a strong federal government. A federalist today is one for state government rights. Opposite.
Yeah, words change. Yeah, they do change. But if you read section 212 says the natives, comma, or natural born citizens, comma, are those born in the country of parents who are citizens. So clearly,
but he told us what those words mean. That's the point. Even though that was an English translation of the word of the first English translation done in 1759, they translated to natives. When they retranslated it in 1797, they called a better translation. They put the words natural born citizen in there. But also in 1781, on the Articles of Confederation, translated a treaty as to the word naturels, which is what the word Vattel used in French. It was translated as natural born. So we're dealing with translations, but choice of words in English compared to words in French. But Vattel clearly defined what he meant. He meant that citizens enjoy the rights and privileges of society, but the natural borns are the ones born in the country of citizen parents. So whether you want to call them X, Y, or Z, he told you what he meant.
Yes, he gave the definition, and there's no doubt that the founding fathers were looking at that particular definition. Even Justice John Marshall in 1814, he was one of the founders.
Right.
In the Venus case, when he started defining what citizenship was, he looked to Vattel. Now, what does that
tell
you? He said
Vattel is the best on this subject, I believe.
Yeah.
Those were his words.
He's a founding. He was a founder. Justice
right.
John Marshall. He was of that generation. Why would he look to Vattel to define citizenship if it was the English common law that did it? It makes absolutely no sense, okay? I mean, there's tons of information on this, and this will all be briefed, you know, if the Supreme Court, of course, takes this case and asks for a briefing on the meaning of natural-born citizen. But the point is that, and Charlie said something very important. He said that Vattel told us what a citizen was, and he also told us what a natural-born citizen was.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's very, very, very important, because if you look at Article 2, okay, it talks about citizens of the United States, and it talks about natural-born citizen, you see? So, and what's also very important is that you have to understand that the United States of America, has a unique experience because it's an infant state created from a revolution. So when that happens, when you replace one government with another, the first question that you have is, well, wait a minute. You know, we just started a new country. Who are the citizens? Okay, so that's why.
Well, there's another point there, though, Mario, is that there were actually 13 independent sovereign states after the Revolutionary War. There wasn't a solid United States of America yet. There was just an article of confederation of 13 independent sovereign states. They didn't look to the common law of any one state and the constitution of any one state to form the federal government. They didn't look to the common law of England, who they just threw off. They looked to universal law, natural law, and the law of nations to unify 13 independent states and create a federal government that would govern 13 independent and sovereign states. They didn't look to any particular country's law. They looked to the law of nations.
Right, which was based on natural law, but the point is, when they created the Constitution, they had to say, well, who's a citizen? Okay,
right.
Now we're talking about after the 13 colonies. Now they're creating the United States of America, and mm-hmm. they said, well, who's the first? We have to have citizens to start with. Those were your members of society. That's why Vattel describes the citizens as members of society. Okay, there's a very it's like a, an entry level membership, and if you read Pufendorf, okay, he'll tell you that when a society is created, those who were born into the society, those who were here, those who made that society, those are your citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Those are your citizens, and that's exactly what Vattel says.
They're
they're
the original citizens.
Yeah, and that's what the founders said in Article 2. That if you're a citizen now, you can be president, okay? Because you're an original citizen. You're here during the revolution. You're an older person. You were born not in the United States. You were born in the colonies. Your parents were British, okay? But because you were born into this new government, and you adhere to it, you were a citizen. You were an entry level member of that society, and that's what Vattel starts out with, okay? But then Vattel says. But the children of those citizens are your natural-born citizens, natives, you see?
The second generation of citizens in the
right,
country.
Right. And, of course, that's confirmed by
– And the purpose of that is that that those natural-borns are well-marinated in the culture and the society they are a member of. They're born into it, and their parents were citizens and were loyal to that country. So the natural-borns – are marinated with two generations of the culture from their parents, and they lived it themselves. So that's the way you get the loyalty innate in that person to the belief in that society, that country, to be able to be the commander of our military, to somebody that we can trust is going to protect us and is not going to be influenced by a foreign national father who never swore allegiance to this country.
And Vattel says that it is only those children of the citizens who will perpetuate the society.
Exactly.
They will perpetuate it. So in other words, there's your preservation of the new United States of America. It's gonna be up to the children of those initial, because those initial citizens, they still have that natural allegiance. They could be homesick.
They bled to create the country.
Well, yeah,
that's right.
They proved their allegiance by bleeding for the country.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. They overcame their natural allegiance, okay? And therefore the founder says, well, look, we can trust these individuals to be the president, because, my God, who else you going to have? Your children are not old enough. You got to start someplace. So you
That's right.
Start with,
even logic
start.
Tells you have to start with your first set of citizens.
That's right.
Exactly.
That's right. So I want to just like segue just a little bit in here for a second, because I want to point out, of course, the tremendous PR to just consider Article 2, Section 5, Section 1, Clause 5, as meaning just, quote, born in the USA, and why the historic research and filings here have definitively proved that Hamilton said
Hamilton proposed
that
simplicity, and they rejected it.
That's correct. And so this is what has to be seen and heard, and what will be heard. And when that is there, the only record that exists is the record that's been done here. There is no, for those of you who are listening to this and think, well, you know, Blackstone's got an argument, I want to say prove it. Where is it? You can't find Blackstone cited in the Declaration of Independence or the U.S. Constitution. So,
but you can find the Law of Nations. The concept of the Law of Nations is in there.
Correct.
Blackstone was important when it came to states' questions.
Right.
Okay. The English common law, contracts, property, inheritance, torts, He was the authority on English common law, which was used in the states for local questions. Okay? That was Blackstone. But when it came to